welcome to the Talking Split podcast for episode three or four.
I don't know. We're rolling though, we're dominating.
Exactly. Obviously, you've heard Justin Shaw already, who's in town with us, Mike Zeppel as well.
Hello, boys.
Thanks for your time. We are at Melbourne United headquarters for this one. There's a big guest coming up who you'll hear fairly shortly. Please do get in touch with us. Leave ratings, reviews, any interaction would be fantastic with on the email. You can get us on Twitter as well. Justin, you're...
JShuler15.
I'm Rob Calder. Mike is...
still the same as last week. Yeah. We still aren't sure.
Black Ops, effectively. Like, you cannot find Zeppel anywhere on social media. Like, he's possibly got another family we don't know about somewhere else, and he's just trying to play it off.
Hello, but... Robbie.
But any interaction would be great. You can obviously hashtag it with Talking Split. We have had a lot of emails over the last couple of weeks with some different topics, which we're going to try and get to over the next little bit. But we did have an opportunity come up to interview our next guest, and I'm far too good to resist. Justin Shuler has come through with the goods for us. He promised on last week's podcast we would have some big time guests and round table, and probably none bigger at the moment than Melbourne United, Dean Vickerman. And we're at Melbourne United headquarters at the moment. This is the off week with the FIBA games going on. Dean, thanks very much for joining us. It's been fantastic to give up your time for this as well. It's, we know it's a very busy schedule this time of year. But where did it all start for you with your coach, like even your basketball? Like, where did you first get involved in basketball, and where did that take you with your playing a little bit and mainly your coaching?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in Warragul, and father was an AFL player, played, won a thirds premiership and played some reserves games for Carlton. And so he kind of bounced around with school teaching and coaching footy clubs after that. And then he, in the off season for coaching footy, he wanted the boys to do an activity. And so started up the basketball club, the Warragul Gladiators at the time, and got them going, and that grew to a point where everyone loved it, and so that got divided into another club, and some, suddenly the club system of basketball kind of grew in Warragul, and he really enjoyed it. And from a young age, I think I was 12, and he had me coaching the under 10s, and so there was always a coaching kind of pathway there for me to get involved in it, and certainly enjoyed passing on the knowledge that I had.
Is there something from your dad you still kind of have in your coaching today that you kind of got from back then?
Well, I remember him coaching me at Auskick, and I loved drop kicks back in the day. And I've kicked a drop kick and it smacked the kid in the face, didn't lift over, and I thought it was real funny. But Dad gave me a hard time on the drive home, saying, "What are you doing kicking a drop kick? You got an open goal, kick it over your head." And I was like, "Oof," I thought this was a bit of fun. But he always wanted me to be better, and I think I've tried to do that with our players to to celebrate little successes, but to always find a way to continue to try and challenge them to be better.
Yeah. So your country pathway, so you did everything in the country pathway, so like Jamboree, Skills Days, all those sorts of things along the way?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they were all around, back in those days, but I remember I had an opportunity to coach at the Jamboree, and it was fairly early on. Might have been one of the first country cups that I got to play at. And I still remember I had to do that opening speech. And that word participate, for some reason, I must have said it a thousand times.
You're in Zeppel's world on that one.
But that was obviously a lot of fun. And then I think it was the CBC or something that we, I went back and coached Warragul and player coached, that team to a little championship with a bunch of my mates. Later on as well. So state teams, we had good success, made the grand final under 16s, and finished third, getting knocked out by Metro in under 18s, and then obviously to join together with the Metro group for under 20s and get a pretty significant win. I think it was 165 or something in the grand final of that group with six or seven guys that were already playing NBL.
Yep. That's incredible. How did you transition, I suppose, from your elite level coaching? So you've been an elite level player, you played in the NBL as well, your state team successes and things like that. How did you transition into coaching at the elite level as well? Like, it's a big change.
Yeah, and I started from the bottom again. Yep. You know, for Lindsay, you know, I was fortunate to get a job with Basketball Victoria as a development officer for the Western region, and so to just go back out and be one of his disciples, and you know, go ahead and just get as many school clinics done in the week as possible, and run the hoop time, you know, competitions, and so to have that little admin side and the coaching side, you know, certainly set me up to go ahead and take on the coaching director job in Geelong. And you know, there was a lot of experienced coaches down there, and so to spend a lot of time with them and try and develop a philosophy of how we wanted basketball played down there, you know, was a good challenge for me to, you know, to still be fairly young and 40-50-year-old men, you know, bouncing, you know, challenging each other about the game and how we wanted to see our kids play, you know, really helped me develop, I think.
Yep. Was that your first exposure to NBL at that time as well, when you were down in Geelong?
From a coaching point of view, yeah, it was. So, you know, I was very fortunate to, you know, David Crocker was the CEO down in Geelong at that time, and he allowed me, you know, those moments to go out and help Stacker and Lamanis as they were putting that Geelong program together. And so, yeah, real volunteer role. And I've always tried to continue to do that. You know, when I came back from coaching in New Zealand, you know, Lindsay, same thing again. Just let me hang around practice and volunteer your time. And, you know, it's what I keep telling our coaches, you know, if you want something, you're going to have to invest the time in it. And, you know, in basketball, you can find a lot of little part-time roles to certainly make a living out of. But if you want to be an NBL coach, you've got to find a way to get to practice.
We've spoken about that a lot on this pod in the last kind of 6 months. The people, or the, you know, the five or six relationships that you value and the people that you spend the most time with is ultimately going to shape your philosophy and your outlook on coaching, and you know, the fact that you can put yourself out there, and that's for our coaches as well, put yourself out there, not asking for money. All you're asking for is experience and some knowledge, and to put yourself in those situations, you just acquire it over time, and it helps shape exactly how you value, or what you value in the game.
It's amazing how many people we talk to comes back to Lindsay. Like, I reckon every person we talk to about, hey, where did you get started in basketball? It's like, oh, Lindsay, you know, you had me at the old Albert Park days, and it's just incredible how much of the coaching tree comes back to that. And it's, I mean, we talk about the five or six people you talk to the most. Mm. I reckon anyone probably over the age of about 40 attributes a lot of it to Lindsay, or still talks to Lindsay. It's,
yeah, and I think he struggled to say no to players. You know, someone turn up off the street and you know, can I come and practice? And, you know, he'd have
25 people.
Yeah, 25 people to practice some days, and we're kind of looking around. But, you know, that's where how he was with coaches as well, to say, you know, can I come to practice? I don't think he would have ever said no to anybody. And so
awesome.
If you keep coming, you know, there would be a role that develops, or he'll find something for you in his network of people that, you know, might challenge you to go a bit further.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Your time with the state teams. So you coached a couple of state teams, Victoria. What age groups were you mainly with those guys?
Yeah, I think I was assistant. I was an apprentice coach under 20s, and then I think I did assistant coach for 3 years as well. So, you know, I think we won all those championships. You know, Dave Anderson, you know, was a part of those. You know, Luke Egan, you know, back to Zeppel.
Yeah. I was hoping you'd mention that. I was really hoping.
You know what, I was hoping you wasn't going to mention
it. My smile was getting bigger.
He's going to be one of the forgettable ones.
That was a good team.
Yeah, it was a very good team.
Very, very good teams. And, you know, it's good to see, you know, a lot of those guys go and play fantastic basketball in the NBL or internationally and for the country.
Definitely. So you spent a little bit of time in the Big V League as well, which obviously Basketball Victoria involved with. Which teams were you with in the Big V?
Big V. So I had Melbourne University. Yep. when I came back from New Zealand. That was, you know, it was a great experience. I didn't really know too much about the Big V at that time, and didn't know much about what Melbourne Uni was about either. But, yeah, so they did some interesting things, being students and the challenges of, you know, trying to run a semi kind of professional program with what's going on with their studies and their social life. And but they really got into it, and they allowed us to bring a couple of young Tigers in with Adrian Sturt, came into that group and, you know, really developed as a player and you know, went on to play some NBL games as well. You know, went up to my home, up to, you know, what used to be the Gippsland Lakers and then the Latrobe Energy, and, you know, really enjoyed that experience as well. Travelling from Melbourne was obviously, you know, the struggle, you know, the hours that you put in to try and get up to a couple of practices a week. And, you know, we had Liam Norton and a couple of guys travelling up with us, and you know, they had a bad car accident, you know, the three of them, Nick Masunda, and we had a guy named Joe Hook as well who was travelling up there. And so the three guys were in a bad car accident that knocked them out for the season. And then I took off to Singapore, you know, halfway through the season as well. Got that great opportunity to be a part of a new franchise and coach the national team over there.
Yep. That's a great segue because we're ready to start talking about the NBL journey, I suppose.
You've done this before.
Yeah, this is way more professional than we are for a start. I mean, you talked a little bit, I suppose, about how you got your start in the NBL, but Stax was your head coach when you jumped in, I believe.
Yeah, so Stax was there in Geelong when, you know, that was my first experience, and then, you know, Brett Brown gave me my first opportunity at North Melbourne Giants, so... Yeah, left the coaching director role after about 3 years in Geelong and took on, you know, a second assistant role. And Stax ended up in that role as the assistant coach as well, with Brett Brown. And then he actually, when that fell over, Stax went to Townsville and he gave me a call and said, hey, there's this job in Rockhampton. You know, how would you be interested in doing that one? So, you know, to go up in the Queensland State League for a couple of years as well, you know, really isolated town of Rockhampton, but great basketball town. And, you know, the travel of that one was ridiculous to drive to Mackay, which is 3.5 hours or whatever, was your closest road trip, and then to get on a bus overnight and get up to Cairns and Burdekin and Townsville on a triple up that one, and or go 8-9 hours down to Brisbane for a road trip down there with the girls. And, you know, those boys like to drink on the way home as well. There was certainly, certainly a few bus pullovers on the way home. But, you know, great times and, you know, again, learn a lot. Some great experiences, you know, in that one.
So how did the Singapore job come about? Because that's probably one of the ones, I mean, it got you a national coaching job, obviously, as well, but as well as being involved with the Slingers up there. How did that come about?
Yeah, I'd had a relationship with Bob Turner when I was at... I wanted to be in Sydney for the Olympics, and so I took a job as a... I was a CEO role of Sydney Comets, and really didn't know too much about being a CEO, and found out after 6 months I still didn't know too much about that kind of role. And, you know, again, I volunteered my time going to watch Brett Brown's practices and then watching the women's practices as well. And so that really turned into, you know, a role with them, and we ended up winning the championship with the women with Karen Dalton, and Tom Maher took a job in the WNBA. And so again, just being, you know, volunteering your time and being an asset, you know, to practice, you know, allowed me to pick up a role and win a championship. The Singapore one, so I had a relationship with Bob Turner while I was in Sydney during that period, and then we won the championship in 06 with the Tigers. And you know, my role was going to be very similar the next year, and I wanted to challenge myself to go a little bit further and you know, to take a first assistant role. But the national team was a big carrot for me to say, you know, I always wanted to be involved in international basketball and had no idea, you know, what the standard or level or was going to be like, and, you know, how our basketball of, you know, being a part of the shuffle and different things, how could you run that with a team in Singapore and with a national team. And so, yeah, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, the Asian style and changing my philosophy to, you know, to change to what the strengths of the talent that you have.
I think adaptability is probably something we talk about a fair bit on the podcast, yeah, as well, is just trying to find ways to make things work. And that's a completely different culture shift, as you say. Like, personnel is going to be totally different, the Asian style of basketball as well. Like, it's just being able to be adaptable is a huge part of coaching, I think. It's something that's probably undervalued by a lot of coaches.
Is international still part of the coaching path for you right now? Is that still a goal?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was never really any ambition to do something in the NBA, and to have that opportunity, this year to actually coach against an NBA team was something that was far reaching that I'd never really had in my mind at all. So, to experience that, it'd always been to get to the elite tournaments of the world, to get to a world championship, to get to an Olympics.
Beautiful.
I mean, relationships are obviously massive in basketball, but your time in New Zealand as well. I mean, you've had a lot of time with Andre prior to that role, and then getting the opportunity in New Zealand. What was that like, shifting again? I mean, it's got to be tough on your family for a start, like moving them around a lot. But how did you go with that role as well?
Yeah, the Singapore experience was fantastic, and loved working for Gordy over there and learned a lot from him. My wife fell pregnant. The team wasn't sure whether they were going to survive the next year. They could give me no guarantees that I was going to have a job. And when you got a baby on the way, you want some more security than maybe you're going to have a job. So, applied for the New Zealand job. And it's probably the lengthiest interview process that I've been through, strengths tests and personality tests. And, they went the full gamut to be able to get that job. And there was a lot of, good candidates. Obviously, I had worked with Andre before when I was in Geelong, and we kind of coached the VBA team together. But it was highly contested. And, really happy I got the opportunity to go there at that time when they were just really building and being able to start to attract great free agents, like Tony Ronaldson came over to get some of the best New Zealand players backing, in Kirk Penny, and then, really bring in CJ, which was the catalyst to the winning the three championships in a row. But, I saw Andre, change and grow a lot through that period, and just the more ownership that he gave players and, let it really become a coach-led, player-driven culture. Was a lot of fun.
How does that impact on you as an assistant coach? So you're going there with your mind on this is what it's going to be, and you see the head coach change along the way. How does that change you as well as an assistant coach?
Yeah, I loved it, I just try to bring. And the feedback I continued to get as an assistant coach was, they just loved my passion and my enthusiasm for practice every day. And I think, even as a player, I loved practice. It was fun for me. I loved competing. I loved competing with my mates. And if you've got good friends on your team, it makes it enjoyable to go to practice every day and get after it. And so I try to bring that as a coach. And then Andre continued to just give me a little bit more every year, to go away. Dino, let's find me a new zone. And so to go research something in the off season and practice it with other teams and then put it into practice and have a go at it for a while. It's like, yep, tried it. We don't like it now. And move on and try something else. And so I loved, the challenges that he gave me. And I loved as the defensive coordinator of that team that, how we built a reputation of being a really solid defensive team as well.
Mm. You talk about going into programs that are building. That seems to have been a bit of a trend for yourself. Is that kind of what gives you the most coaching kick, is going into programs that kind of need to go from a starting point and get to that end point?
Yeah, well, I obviously didn't enjoy the North Melbourne Giants when you go in, and it came to a very abrupt end. I'm always, if there's a fork in the road, I'm going to take the one that I haven't done before.
Yep.
And so that was the Singapore one, and certainly that was the New Zealand one. And, I've always enjoyed player development. You do a little lot less of that as a head coach these days because you have really good people around you. But so now program development is the part that, really keeps, me ticking every day about how do we make this program better.
Yep.
I think you spoke about passion and enthusiasm. We sensed that as observers this morning at practice, not just from yourself, but the staff, and then the competition amongst the athletes was really good. And that was probably the first thing I was told as a young coach in the US as well, was, the 55-year-old head coach is not going to ask the 25-year-old assistant for his X's and O's advice. But if you can bring that passion and enthusiasm to practice, it sticks out, and then it drives the culture and drives the environment. And I think that's a huge thing that we talk about on the metro side with our coaches. Like, you have to be able to create that environment where athletes want to invest their time to get better. And that really stood out. Robbie and I spoke about that before with practice this morning.
Yeah, I'm pleased that that's what you saw. You know, and that's nice to get. It's always great to get feedback, and that's what, you know, probably going back to Lindsay to say, why did he have people come into practice? Because people were able to give an outside opinion of what they saw, and you can always, you know, it's a good judge of how you're going a little bit if, you know, if outsiders come in and haven't seen you practice for a while can make comment like that. But, you know, that it's taken time. It's taken a lot of, you know, trust in everybody, and there's, you know, we've got much better at, you know, critical feedback and accepting feedback. And I think once everyone's got to that point where, you know, it doesn't matter what people say to you, they're trying to make you better. And I think that's where we've got to with this group.
What about the challenges of inheriting a bit of a roster? So when you took over the New Zealand role from Andre, there are obviously some blocks in place. When you've taken over this United job, there are a lot of blocks in place. What are the challenges surrounding that? Because it's not a quick fix with anything that you sort of sit there and say, hey, that doesn't quite suit me. How do you go about fixing that?
Yeah, it was, you know, I got it in New Zealand when I had the Waikato Pistons in the National League over there for 3 years. You know, Murray McMahon, who was involved in the national program, won a championship and passed away. And so I got, and you know, you take over a championship team over there, and we were able to, you know, repeat. We were able to do it, and you know, Paro Cameron was a huge part of that. But we brought in Adam Ballinger and Justin Bailey, and we had good local talent. We, and, you know, the start of the Abercrombie Pledger, you know, them just coming out of college and getting their first start, and so, you know, for me, I saw that one and what we achieved there, and something similar to this program here, where you had really good talent, you had really good experience. You know, now could you just find a way to bring them together? And then I guess everybody from the outside saw that as the biggest challenge with this group. How can you blend them all together? How can you keep, you know, all those talent happy? And it's not your job to try and keep everybody happy as a coach. It's to do what is needed to do to get the result. But again, people have been willing to sacrifice a little bit of their role. Casper, Chris, giving up a little bit of scoring to share the basketball. Casey, same thing. And so everybody was willing to give up a little bit for their teammate, and that's when you know when you've got a good team.
And same with the coaching staff, I suppose. I mean, you've inherited a coaching staff that Mike and Simon were here previously. You've worked with those guys in the past, I'm assuming?
Yeah, no, me and Simon played together on a Victorian under-20 team. He was bottom age on that team I spoke about before. You know, Mike obviously had a relationship with just being an assistant coach in the league at similar times and head coach, and seeing him around and seeing him play, you know, when I was playing as well. So, you know, the first thing I did was chuck them both on a plane. Let's go to America. Let's bounce for 2 weeks all over the States. Let's get up at 4 a.m. Let's do it tough. Let's, you know, share rooms, do things, and see how we go as a coaching staff together. Because, you know, obviously there was other guys I'd work with that had shown interest in the role. So, you know, really wanted to give those two the first opportunity to say, yep, they're going to be, you know, on board with what I'm about. And, you know, but they're totally committed coaches. They do whatever is needed, you know, do whatever time is needed, and they love it, and they're passionate about it. And so to have those two, and then now to bring in Justin, who's...
You don't have to flag. No, that's not what this podcast is.
No, really, to bring him in and the knowledge that he has. I wanted a younger coach around, and he's not that young, but
young enough
compared to us Grays, you know, to just continue to bring different ideas. And I think that's what you need as a head coach. You just want people to keep throwing different ideas at you, and you know, their acceptance of saying coach doesn't like that one, but I'll give him another one tomorrow, you know, and being able to take and know that, you know, I'm going to listen, and some of those things that you throw up, I'm going to use.
How do you filter those out? Well, that's three staff members, obviously, all with opinions and experiences, and there's a reason. How do you go about filtering out so many ideas? Because as a head coach, that's something that we can get so caught up on. Hey, I'm just going to use that straight away, and you know what's right for you. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah, I was actually, you know, that's your gut. I think that's your real coaching gut, because you have so many people. You have someone every day that believes that they can help your program. And that's what I love about this job. You know, it's coming on your phone, your people that you see in the street, people that you see at a basketball stadium, everyone's going to have something for you. And, you know, if you can just listen and you know, my field is pretty large, I'll say, yep, I think there's something in that, let's try it, or, you know, just dismiss it and say, yep, maybe that's one for the off-season that we'll give a bit more time to. But I think that's one of the luxuries of this role, is that you do have so many people, you know, challenge your filter to say, what do you use, what do you throw away?
Justin, how did you go with this as well? So obviously these guys went away on a trip and you've come in late to that. How do you come in without upsetting the culture of the coaching staff as well?
Yeah, it's something I was really kind of conscious of early on, and then Dino just kind of said to me one day, like, if you see something, tell me. And I just went, right, I'm doing that. And I think since then I probably have. But the thing for me was, it was an accepting culture, like, straight away. That's athletes and staff. And I think the strength of everything that happens here is that common goal, and everyone just doing their part and trying to keep the path. So there's no egos in it. It's just everyone's trying to help out to achieve, and that's really led by Dean and what he's been able to build and change over the course of the season.
Yeah. I think culture is probably a bit of a buzzword that everyone throws up, and hey, culture matters, without really understanding what culture is. What, for you, Dean, is your culture as a coach that you want to promote within your programs?
Yeah, and it should be different everywhere you go. You know, I think there's going to be some common themes if you put a bunch of 12 elite athletes in a room and you talk about, you know, what are the values that are most important to your group, you're going to come up with four or five words that are very similar. And that's been true from when I've changed clubs and changed countries. But then it's the other part about it, to say, all right, the behaviours that go with trying to achieve, you know, those values that are important to you, and then how you manage those behaviours, whether that be, you know, the discipline from a coaching staff, and as you get better, the players being able to, you know, hold that culture true to each other and live it themselves. And that's the biggest part. And once everybody understands what the right thing is, pretty much once it's set out and, you know, guided a little bit. So, you know, to me, the true test of that culture is, you know, can you get to a situation pretty much every day where you say, you know, is that the right behaviour for, you know, who we are as a club? And you always get challenged, and sometimes you get it wrong, and then players get it wrong, and there's consequences, you know, for those actions. And but, you know, you've got to believe in people that, you know, they're going to make some mistakes, and, you know, can they get better from it? And, you know, certainly, again, a philosophy that Lindsay had at the Tigers back in the day, and, you know, it's okay to make a mistake, just don't make the same one twice and learn from it, and then we kind of held that true with this club as well.
I think with culture comes accountability, and that's probably one of the biggest things. Is watching the United guys at training this morning, there was utmost accountability. Anytime someone missed a closeout, missed a rotation, didn't talk on something, there was someone telling them. It didn't necessarily come from the coaching staff every time, it was players within themselves. So that, to me, like watching that, that's a great culture to have, when players can sit there and say, hey, you need to talk this because I'm getting hit on that pick and you're not saying anything. And it just be accepted. Like, yep, got it, no worries. Like, that's a great sign for your culture straight away. Like, you can hold people true to that.
Yeah, and I felt myself, you know, in the last couple of months, you know, not doing as much of that. Because it's getting done, whether it be from assistant coaches or whether it be from, you know, the players themselves. And that's the ultimate, to say, if we have an injured player, which we've had recently, what kind of impact are they still having in practice? Are they holding people accountable on the sidelines in what they see? You know, Chris started that early in the year when he was out, and you know, he's, the growth that he's had as a leader has been phenomenal. To go from a point where, you know, friendship was really important to him with everybody in the group, and to get to a point now that, you know, he's, the respect that he has from the group is that he's not challenging a friendship with his accountability, everyone. He's just trying to make people better, and you know, he's going to say what needs to be said to people, and people are accepting of that.
Talk about, Dino, how much you value the athlete's opinion in things. Like, that's something I've really taken from you this year, is how often you'll ask the guys about certain things and getting that, that two-way feedback, I guess.
Yeah, and I think when you start it by, you know, you guys tell us what you want the culture to be at the club, you know, it starts right there. And I think we believe we're pretty smart as coaches, but we get it wrong sometimes. We don't always have the answer. So if you don't have, you know, you've got four coaches all talking and you're still a little muddled in your decision, you know, who are you going to go to next? You're going to go to the players. And so, again, during this period of playoff period, that's going to be really important, because we're not out on the floor. We can't make decisions. We only have so many timeouts. We can only influence the game so much. So for them to be absolutely comfortable and have a lot of buy-in to, you know, the game plan of, you know, how we try and win a semi-final series, is going to be so much on the decisions that they can make in huddles without, you know, any coach being involved in that. So, you know, we've got to do that. We've got so many great experiences on this team with what Dave Anderson's done, Barlow, you know, Chris, all these guys, Josh Boone, you know, we've got so many great experiences. You're stupid not to allow that to grow and allow that knowledge to be spread.
So the season probably wouldn't have gone perfectly. I mean, no season goes perfectly. You had a lot of travel early on, obviously the United trip. What was that like going to OKC and coaching in that environment?
It was really fun, yeah. You know, and we wanted to be competitive. That was the starting point, to not get blown off the floor, to not embarrass our league in any way. That was my first thought. And then once you actually get into the game and, you know, the personalities of, you know, the Paul George and Westbrook and Melo, and, you know, it's like, wow, they're struggling to guard us a little bit as well. And, you know, yeah, we can get a fight over screen here and we can do some things. And so there was just little steps early on to say, wow, we can actually be really competitive. And we've got some players that, you know, don't fear these guys at all. You know, Casper didn't fear it. We had Josh Boone and Dave Anderson speak before the game about just playing at the highest level and, you know, what guys can go and expect, and they did a great job of, you know, setting the tone for the group before we went out for the game. So, you know, I hadn't been at that level. You know, we needed other guys to speak about, you know, their experiences to have a shot to win it. You know, I'm still yet to grab that photo, but it's a photo that I want to have on my wall for a long time about, you know, the three guys that went and go ahead and block the last shot. And, you know, it's a good coaching reminder to say, well, maybe we could have got a different shot at the end there, or we could have done something different, but it'll be a great photo for me to keep that one.
Absolutely. And so that was a great start to the season. Obviously, you had the Adelaide double early up, then the United trip. Had a little bit of a funk sort of early December where just things weren't going right. What did you feel like you just needed to blow this up and start again? Did you feel like you just needed to make small changes? How many times did you consider, hey, I just need to go a complete 180 and go in a completely different direction? Or how much is it just like, you know what, we're close, but we just need to change a couple of things?
Yeah, and I think we always felt like there might be, you know, the schedule might get us a little bit at somewhere with what we did early in the year going to OKC, the two Adelaide road trips, and then we went to Perth for the next trip, and we lost a close one over there. But it was coming off that, you know, that we really went into a hangover after that one, you know, dropped to New Zealand at home and had really no energy, you know, lose a tough one to Brisbane up there, and I think we dropped three in a row at that point. And so, and we also had, you know, Chris coming back, you know, for that period where, you know, it's one of the challenges that I've learnt this year to say, we were great anytime someone got injured and the next man up and people stepped up. That's an easy part of coaching, just understand, let people know what the new role is. The harder part is when people are coming back from injury and how you incorporate them back in. And so we obviously did that different with Chris, where I was stubborn enough to say, let's just chuck him straight in there. You know, he's going to be a 30-minute guy for us all year. Why shouldn't he start to play 30 minutes right here? And then we do it differently with Casey Prather later in the season to say, you know, come back in off the bench, work your way back into it and do it a little differently. And probably if you look back now and say, we could have done a little bit more with that with Chris, because we've just played great at OKC, won two games on the road at Adelaide, and now I disrupt it too much by, you know, throwing him straight back in there. When this team was winning, he could have just filtered back in and had a slow approach to come back.
Definitely. This time of year, so we're in the FIBA window when we're recording this. This will come out next week, but we're in the FIBA window at the moment. Is there much of a tendency to say, hey, we've got 2 weeks off now, are we going to change what we do or just keep doing what you've been doing to this point that's been successful? I mean, you're lucky, I say, touch wood, that, you know, Chris got injured last week, so he wasn't playing in the boomer stuff. How much is just, no, we just keep doing what we're doing with some time off here?
Yeah, I think we managed the load well last time and came out well the other side. Some bodies need some freshen up, so... we won't do a lot in the middle weekend of this one, but really pleased with the practices that we've had so far and the intensity that we've played at, and it's been a bit of a theme for us all year. You can either go 100% or practice, or you don't practice. No one practicing at 75% because it just brings your practice down. If someone's going to practice and they're not completely right, well, can you give me 5 minutes of full intensity or 10 minutes of full intensity and then go do something else? But, you can't come into practice and you just be at 50%. You don't help us. And so we kind of stayed with that a little bit all year. And it's mean a lot of different people have practiced and we've had big numbers to be able to allow that to happen. But it's been a real positive for us changing things. Going into a playoff series, it's all just about little tweaks, and it will be in the playoff series as well. Everyone knows how you go about it defensively and offensively and what your strengths and weaknesses are. Can you throw a couple of little wrinkles in there that teams haven't seen, or little adjustments that, the players have done over time about being guarded different ways and how your offense has grown?
Definitely. When we look at sort of talent ID and play development, what are your key philosophies with developing an athlete? Because everyone's going to come to you at a different stage of their career, obviously. You've got Dave Anderson, who's been through the ringer of NBA, Europe, and probably has different goals to a young kid coming through, like a Torhi or someone like that, who's probably not been seen as much as he has this year, and all of a sudden it's flourished over the last couple of months. How do you manage manage both those players, I suppose?
Yeah, I believe you need, a third of your roster that are developing, a third that are in their prime, and a third that are, starting to, be a little bit over their prime. It has a good natural progression of players coming through, at the top right there. How long can those guys continue to find a way to contribute? How willing are they to take a lesser role and to teach someone else their role will be how long, they stay around for. Can you keep, the players in your prime, because there's going to be opportunities for them to play elsewhere during that period? And then can you sell the future to those younger guys within the club and they see a pathway for them to stay and get better? And so everyone is at a different point of their career, and so you don't treat any of them the same other than how you discipline them and how they all live the culture the same. But, their games are totally different. Torhi's at a totally different level to Dave Anderson in his career, so... you've got to coach them differently.
The one thing, though, with that is in practice environments, definitely consistent to everyone. Like the accountability, that's something that I know a few guys have spoken to me over the course of the season as to how it's been so different to maybe years gone by where, 1 through 15 in practice, there's an expectation you get that done or you're going to hear about it. And I think that's been a big key to our success so far.
Yeah, I think all players want to be treated equally in that regard, to say. And I struggled with it at times with Cedric Jackson because he was great at demanding that he get foul calls in practice, and you know, and sometimes he got a couple of extra ones, and certainly, you know, Shea Illies and Shane McDonalds and Reece Carters at different time, you know, never, always felt like they weren't getting a fair deal at practice, but. You know, I thought he was one of the toughest guys to manage at practice every day. Of course, he was pretty emotional with all those things, and you could lose him if you didn't quite give him a couple of little ones that were 50-50. So, you know, tough situation. But this group has certainly been easier, and you know, much easier to referee. In practice, which is something as coaches, you don't want to be the referee. You want practice to kind of, and we had to do a lot of different things in over there. And who called fouls for the day? You know, players would call fouls some days, coaches would call fouls some days, and so we had to keep mixing it up. You know, here there's been a real good honesty that coaches hadn't having to referee too much.
What sort of players do you enjoy coaching? Now, you've been lucky enough that you've had some great players play for you over the course. I know I've certainly got a couple of players that I love watching as a spectator. What are the sorts of players that you love coaching and who are a couple of the examples as well, other than the current Melbourne United crew who you love all equally and respect everyone?
Yeah, again, really, really different. You know, I enjoy people that are really confident and know that they're going to deliver in clutch situations, and you know, that's why I enjoyed, you know, CJ so much, the confidence that he had in not just himself, but the confidence that he had in his teammates, you know, to make them believe that they were even better than they were at different times. You know, Kevin Braswell was similar in that regard, a really big game player, and you know, get spread a great confidence and a relaxed confidence around the group as well. To have the Abercrombies and the Kirk Pennies, who were just absolute perfectionists, and Dave Barlow, you know, and Dave Anderson kind of move into that regard as well. So perfectionists about how they deal with their body, their diet, and they're absolute leaders to the rest of the group in how they go about it. But then, you know, just killers on the court, you know, when their time comes, you know, to go ahead and deliver. And then, you know, the bigs are always different. You know, I really enjoyed, you know, the humour of some of the bigs. And, you know, Pledger was a lot of fun. They're special people, but, you know, they help you so much. And then ultimately, you know, Mika Vekona is, you know, the favourite player that, you know, I've ever had to coach, just because of, you know, his desire to just make a great play in key situations.
Yep. I'm glad you hit on Mika, because that's certainly the guy I enjoy. Well, him and Damian Martin are two of the elite guys for me. Just, you see their leadership on and off the court. For mine, I think it's their body language says a lot, but just their actions as well. They're happy to go and pick a guy up off the floor, you know, slap someone on the back that takes a charge, make the extra pass when they need to make the extra pass. And you look at their box scores and you probably sit there and say, geez, what do they really contribute? But then you look at the plus minus and it's like, well, that's where it is. I think as coaches, that's someone we all enjoy coaching as well. Any advice to up-and-coming coaches? I mean, you've done, like, if we were to put a poster child up of what the pathway is for coaching, you're pretty much it at the moment. You started, as you said, down at the Warragul level and just continued to grow. What would your advice be to coaches also looking to make that sort of pathway, I suppose?
Yeah, I think, you know, it wasn't all smooth. You know, there's certainly some bumps in the road, you know, for me, you know, when I left Rockhampton, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and then to take a basketball administration job when I wasn't very skilled at that, and then, you know, to step away from that and be unemployed for a little while, to leave New Zealand at a time that the club was struggling, you know, was tough, and to come back, tail between my legs, you know, failing over there, back to Australia, and, you know, start from scratch again. And, you know, you go through that period of, you know, do I take a different career path? You know, do I do something else? Is this game going to have the ability to keep me employed? But yeah, my love for the game, my passion for the game, always allowed me And my commitment to being at practices and volunteering and trying to learn and keep talking to people, you know, allowed me to stay employed in the game and allowed me to get to, you know, where I am right now. So, again, if there's the love there for it, you know, find a way. You know, put three or four. You know, I remember when I first came back, I got a job at Dandenong. They allowed me to do some work with Mornington as a coaching director down there. You're doing ITCs in the morning. You know, you're putting all these little bits and pieces together just to be able to live, but still having that freedom to go to an MDL practice and try and get your growth as well. So, yeah, never give up.
Yep, absolutely. Any questions from Justin or Mike?
Just the only other one I have, mate, is I think for coaches, hearing you talk at this length has been outstanding. Those challenging times, the bumps that you talk about, there's always those little voices that give you those self-doubt. Maybe it's a bad loss that you didn't expect and that. What are the methods you've used to kind of just get on to the next part? Because the thing that I've admired through the year is that may occur on the Friday, but by Monday we're into it. So, like, just talk us through that stuff.
We had a chaplain in New Zealand, and you know, my first year over there was tough. You know, we're coming off a three-peat championship, and you take over that team. There's no higher expectation about what's supposed to happen the year after, and you know, to win our first couple of games and then to go on a four-game losing streak, it was like, oof, this is not supposed to happen. I don't know how to deal with this one. So, you know, to sit with him and talk through, you know, the emotions that you were going through. And so he was a big one for me to say, all right, you can be grumpy for 12 hours about the game. But then as soon as that 12 hours is up and the times, you have to have a plan to walk in to your players and say, this is our way forward. And that was great for me. You know, he allowed me to get grumpy. I'm allowed to be disappointed and frustrated and mad about all those things.
Does Chrissy have the clock set at home with that countdown on?
So I'm pretty good at going for a walk and getting out of space where I can make anybody else miserable during that period. But that's our job as coaches. You know, it's about, you know, taking experiences and moving forward, and we've got to be good at it as well. That's all the players want on the Monday morning after a Saturday loss. They want to hear what's the way forward. How do we get better? And so, you know, I love that challenge from week to week.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Dino, you are the best dressed coach in the league. Can you provide any insight into who picks Justin's shirts out for him game? And is there a favourite? Because I've seen the all black ensemble many times.
That's certainly not me. You know, I was the most resistant coach to dress up than anyone. And so, you know, I tried it in New Zealand a couple of times when the league was starting to push it a little bit more. Yeah. We've always been polo shirts over there. The first day I turn up and I'm in a suit, and it's for a rare 35 degree day in New Zealand at the North Shore, and I've sweated it out and we've lost badly. And then in Sydney, I absolutely refused. When Copes and Drewy were dressing up, I said, I'm staying in the polo. And then to come down here and, you know, just to accept it, to say, you know, we have a great sponsor in the men's club, and, you know, they're going to throw us some nice clothes, and Justin gets to pick his own dress code.
I got two shirts, so it's black or it's white.
But I found a level of comfort with chucking a jacket on. If it's too hot, I'm throwing it off.
You know the pressure of the game depending on how long the jacket stays on. That's exactly. It's a good indicator.
Sometimes we don't see the blue check long, it'd be fair to say. So, Dean, thanks very much for your time. I know you've got a really hectic schedule at the moment, and especially this time of year with playoff action coming from obviously all of us at BB and the Talking Split crew. Good luck. Like, we know it's tough to drag Justin through some stuff at times, but you know, you've done a great job, and he's been happier more than unhappy this year. So that's normally a good sign that you're trending in the right direction as well.
It's a good environment to be in.
It is. Good luck for playoffs. Obviously, we wish you all the best with it. And thanks for jumping on the pod with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
massive thanks to Dean Vickerman for jumping in. There's a lot of value you can take in that at all levels of coaching, not just the elite end. I think there's a lot of domestic coaches that probably would have heard a lot of that information, and a lot of aspiring coaches on the pathway as well.
Just the pathway, mate. Like, he is a man that kind of started from the starting point and went right through. And I think what's important and the messaging there is, you know, you've got to keep working at it. You know, the bumps in the road will be there. Mm. Try not to let that discourage you too much, and just keep, if it's a goal, keep chasing that goal.
Yeah, my three takeaways were his ability to seek opportunity. Like, he put himself out there and not ask for anything except for kind of watch practice. And we, Justin and I, tell coaches all the time, your biggest development is watching other coaches coach and run their session for 2 hours. Like, that's, you can't get any better than that.
Before you keep going, I didn't realise how many jobs he's had over the course. And, yeah, like, that's not the sign of a bad coach. Like, that is simply the sign of someone who wants to go and experience a lot of different things in coaching and put time in. Yeah.
And it is something I mean, as we talk to other coaches around that have kind of achieved quite a bit in their career, that will be a common thread. Like, when I've spoken to people and they tell me that, I'm like, God, you coach here, there and everywhere. But it is part of it. You got to keep grinding away at it.
The second one was the relationships that he's been able to build along the way. Really important, because in 15 years' time, the person that you development coached for or volunteer coached for could be the person who needs someone to come be their right-hand man. And that was the case with Dean a couple times now in his career. And the third one was just his passion and enthusiasm for the game, obviously, but just his, the guys, his culture, the team. That's what really stood out. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, on that, there's never a time where Deno comes in and it's like you just know he's having a shit of a day. Like, he comes in and when it's time to get to work, it's like away you go. And I think that's a skill for all of us. Like, there's those mornings where you just like, you know, like today would be a great day off, but, you know, just attack it with passion and motivation and enthusiasm, and it turns out to be a pretty good day.
Yeah, well, even just jumping on the pod, like, we had to ask once, and he's like, yep, love to do it. And, like, we didn't chase him down, which is credit to him. Like, it'd be really easy, especially this time of year, to go, hey, just too busy. Yeah. But straight away said yes, and obviously you can't see the setup we've got going on, but he was on the edge of his seat. He just wanted to talk about coaching, which was fantastic.
I think he values how he got into it. Like, I know myself, I've spoken about it before as well. You know, Stacks let me into his practice environment in Townsville, and that's kind of how that relationship with him started. And, you know, I think that you kind of do appreciate that, and that's why you do let the door be open, and because you know that that's how you can help someone the most. And your point about Lindsay, you know, and that's the culture that was there. And I think it's an Australian culture. Like, we do genuinely want to help each other out. And I think, you know, that really came through in his discussion today.
Yep, definitely. All right, we are on to the most talked about segment of the show, the split, the kick and the extra. We are currently seeking sponsors other than the Basketball Victoria style of play and system of play that we use for this. By all means, hit us up with your sponsorship and we'll make T-shirts for the winners or something like that. This week's split. So, Mike, you've got the negative on this one.
So I get some time to listen.
You get some time to listen.
I'm straight up.
Up by three. Your team's on defense. Are you fouling? Justin, you are the yes. Mike, you are the no. Good to go, Justin.
So I am saying we are fouling, to clarify that.
Yep.
How long to go?
We'll call it, what, nine? 9 seconds.
Nine seconds to go, and I'm fouling up three.
Go.
Okay, the benefit of this for me is that the outcome is going to be guaranteed win. So if I put them to the line and they can make two, great job. I back my rebounders. If they miss that second to secure the ball, then they have to foul us. We walk down the other end, we make the shot. Something you'll see quite a lot done in Europe and is a common strategy there. To me, you always want to have winning as part of the equation. So if I let them come down and they can now stick a three, or one of our players, God forbid, fouls that three-point shot and it goes in, now it's a draw, loss is in the equation. I just want to win the ball game, so I'm going to foul that and put them to the line. Preferably their worst free throw shooter as well.
Okay. Mike, you good?
We live in a fickle world now, gentlemen. You can't foul when you're not allowed to foul. You can't. It's an unsportsmanlike foul. So now we're in a situation where we're going to foul and give the ball back to them after they've made two free throws. Justin, rookie move by you. Fever's changed
Can
all
I
this.
Can I clarify this?
Fever's changed all this. Hey, but how about you just sit down, keep the ball in front of you and defend? Force a contested shot, clean it up, switch all screens, switch all handoffs, make that ball go over the top of you and clean it up and then hit the showers.
The clarification needs to be you do need to be in a legal guarding position in order to foul.
Committee has spoken, Robbie. The negative has won this one.
So that is a very valid point. We had this discussion in the office, obviously, this week, which is what has prompted this. You do need to be in a position with how to foul and yep. bring up a legal guarding position. We've seen a lot of unsportsmanlike fouls called this season in the NBL.
Yeah,
I see it a heap on a Friday night. Like, my under-12s have had 3 unsportsmanlike fouls called in our games, thankfully never on us. But yep. we're seeing it at all levels because the mentality is we have to go and foul. You can still foul. You just have to do it from a legal guarding position.
Yeah, and so that's clear. That's being in front. So you can't foul, reach around, foul from behind like you used to be able to. You can't grab a shirt. You can't put 2 hands on. You've got to kind of make a play at the ball. And it is something we actually went through with the guys at the NBL level to say, like, this is what we can and can't do because of how much it was getting called.
It's become something you have to practice now because even if you're running alongside somebody and you foul them, you are now up to the mercy of yeah. the officials. And it won't even be flagrant. It won't even be unsportsmanlike. There was a crazy one last week up in the Brisbane player got a crazy one. He barely touched the other athlete. But
I can tell you this. There was yeah. one game where we were up in that exact same scenario. I can't remember the game. Actually, I do. It was Brisbane when Trice had the 3 at the buzzer. And I'd thrown that to Dino, that let's foul, put him on the line. And he basically said, I'm afraid we're going to get an unsportsmanlike. So we played it out.
Yeah.
And Trice wasn't far off as sticking that 3. So, it definitely puts a challenge into your coaching. FIBA have cleaned it up because of how far Europe had taken it with yeah. fouling and using that strategy. It just means coaching it a little bit different. But legal guarding position, I'm still fouling so I can get the win, Rob.
Very good, Justin. You'd have to try and clarify that at some point. The kick this week is with Mike.
Yeah, I'm going to kick something that is really important for the development of coaches and athletes in Australia. We do have an issue here in Melbourne. Justin's got issues in regional Victoria as well.
Yeah, we're going through something right now.
But I know around the country, court space is a massive issue. And it's not as easy as us just saying, you know, let's build a dozen new courts where we need them. But I think something does need to happen. We need to figure something out as a body, as a sporting body, as a basketball body, how we can provide access for athletes and coaches to get to the basketball floor. So
the massive challenge with that is also, so we talk about high performance and, you know, really high performance should be the optimal training time for yeah. athletes to get on the floor and get the work in.
Yeah.
Well, our best athletes, our future boomers and opals are often having to train early morning or late at night because of other events that are going yeah. on. Now, all those other events should be going on as well, but absolutely. What we're definitely saying is there is an absolute need for more court space to have our kids get better on and have the opportunity to play the sport. The other one, though, up in Horsham that I touched on, like, we need courts everywhere in regional Victoria, absolutely. The interesting one in Horsham is the council are now trying to take over operation of the stadium. So Horsham Basketball, who have ran it phenomenally well for a long time, Owen Hewen, legend of the sport, now are getting told, well, no, we're going to come in and commercialise this a bit, up the price, and now that's going to have an impact on the sport in there. So there's so many different angles on it. If commercialising means more courts, then maybe there's an argument for that. But if that's not the case, then yeah. that's concerning that basketball people are getting taken out of a stadium.
Yeah, and that is, like Justin touched on, the high performance section, which we're heavily involved in, but the sport's in a really good place because we have, you know, programming in place for our 6, 7, 8-year-olds
yeah,
who are able to do that.
Grassroots exactly. level is huge
yeah,
at the moment
exactly.
in the sport.
So,
and just the sport in general, like yeah. the interest in the sport is phenomenally big right now.
Yeah.
You know, you look at what's happening in the NBA with our Aussies, articles getting written every day, NBL attendance is up,
yeah.
participation's up. Like, every angle of the sport is growing. And, you know, the Boomers are playing in Melbourne this week. You know, there's international, world's best in our backyard. So it's time that we can definitely help that out.
The The extra is Justin.
Well, the extra goes on a little bit further on that, and overnight, the talk of the Essendon Bombers coming into the NBL.
This is going to, just before you keep going, this is going to cause massive angst for Justin straight away. He's going to be conflicted as anything if they come into the league.
They're the enemy in the NBL, but the best AFL team around. But what we do feel is that it's a huge positive for, one, the league, that more teams are coming in. Having rival games in Melbourne would be a phenomenal thing again, like just something that has been missing in the state for quite some time, but also more playing opportunities, more coaching opportunities, more admin opportunities, and the growth of the sport through media circles, everything. So while some may think that, you know, from a Melbourne point, Melbourne United only want one team, I can tell you that more teams in the league is something that everyone that's involved wants, and it's great to see that it's on the doorstep of expansion at this point in time.
I've asked a few people just randomly in the last 6 weeks or so, like if Richmond had a football club, basketball club, you know, would you go watch them play? And the answer, consensus has been, yeah, absolutely. And I've used different clubs as an example, but I think people would buy into it. I think people would really buy into that model. It
doesn't just have to be AFL clubs expanding, you know, like any teams coming in right now. I think the depth of talent is getting greater and greater by the year
college
that goes by.
There's
a hugely talented college group coming back out that are going to be looking for jobs in the world. If we could have a league that those kids just lob back in, plus we've got the import talent that we've got this year, like some of the best imports the league's ever had. You know, the national team players coming back in. Like, there's so much of a positive spin on it. More teams, the better.
Yep. Completely agree. It's going to be fantastic for the sport. And never hurts to have more competition, let's face it.
Absolutely.
Like, that's exactly what we're after. The NBL's been fantastic the last couple of years because of the level of competition. If we can up that again, now all of a sudden we have an incredibly thriving product and their grassroots is only getting any more.
Yep.
And the more and more our grassroots gets on, the more stadiums we get. So Zeb's happy.
Yes.
That's really what's important in all of
it. But it is a trickle effect, and you know, people often complain about how much money goes into like Olympic level sport, but there's a true indicator that when the Boomers do well or the Opals do well, there is an impact at a grassroots level, and that's why it matters. And then if our national leagues are thriving, the NBL, the WNBL, then our underpinning leagues, the Siebel, and now again, like every league gets a little bit better, the sport becomes even more popular and there's a sustainability for a long time, which will allow us to be a medal nation in both men and women at the Olympics.
And especially with 3-on-3 coming in the Olympics now, just another opportunity for us to medal. The more access to courts we have, obviously the better, but that will grow everywhere, and that's what we want the sport to be. I saw Jerry West made a comment, the All-Star game, basketball will be the biggest sport in the world inside about 5 years, I think he was talking about.
He did.
And it's hard to disagree with.
It's almost number one in America now. So
the logo.
Yep. It's good enough for them. It's
beautiful.
Good enough for us. Obviously, what do you got, Zep?
I was going to say, I'm calling it early. Best pod ever.
Best pod ever. Wow. Okay. We have a lofty bar to try and to reach for the next little bit. We'll see how we go. Big thanks, obviously, to Dean Bickerman from Melbourne United. We wish them all the best in their finals run. And you too, of course, Justin.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you, you know, on that bench in the black shirt or the white shirt, depending on which day of the week it is.
It rotates, so you can usually pick it.
You've never considered going the full blazer?
No. It's way too hot down on those on the side
that
of those
makes court. Sense. Makes sense. Good luck to the Melbourne United guys, and appreciate Dean jumping on. Again, you can hit us up on email or on social media if you are interested in interacting a little bit more, or if there's a topic that you want to discuss. We do have a couple of different ones coming up over the next couple of weeks that people have emailed in, which is fantastic. Good luck with your coaching, and we'll talk to you guys next week.